Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Hello, and welcome to episode 229 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. We're here today with Eli Rosenbaum, the longest-serving prosecutor and investigator of Nazi criminals and other perpetrators of human rights violations in world history. Eli is the director of human rights enforcement strategy and policy at the Department of Justice's Human Rights and Special Prosecution Section and is the former director of the United States Department of Justice Office of Special Investigations. Eli, thanks so much for joining me today. How are you? Hello?
Hello.
Hello, and welcome to episode 229 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. We're here today with Eli Rosenbaum, the longest-serving prosecutor and investigator of Nazi criminals and other perpetrators of human rights violations in world history. Eli is the director of human rights enforcement strategy and policy at the Department of Justice's Human Rights and Special Prosecution Section. He is the former director of the United States Department of Justice's Office of Special Investigation. Eli, thanks so much for joining us. How are you doing today?
Great to be with you, Jordan. Thanks for having me.
Right. So the first question I'd like to pose to you is, Eli, what are you currently doing or what have you ever done to advance the public interest and why?
Well, I hope I've advanced the public interest in partnership with a lot of great colleagues here at the Department of Justice and elsewhere in the federal government and sometimes in partnership with people at NGOs. So I've been working really since 1980 on federal investigations and prosecutions of persons who participated or are suspected of having participated in World War II Nazi crimes and also in post-World War II human rights violations in places like Rwanda, Bosnia, Guatemala, a tragically long list. So what we do in these cases is pursue accountability in the hope that some measure of deterrence will be obtained to reduce the frequency of human rights violations. I think you can look around the world and say we haven't been all that successful, alas.
So I guess in considering what you've been doing, which is pursuing individuals who you would like to prosecute for violations of human rights across throughout the latter half of the 20th century, it kind of begs the question, well, what are human rights? And who would determine if they're a violation of human rights? I know the United Nations Geneva Convention established at the end of World War II some basic tenets of what human rights are, but I'm wondering if there's any cultural, if different human rights could be different in different societies. So, could you start with a discussion on, I guess, how we determine what human rights are and if they're just determined by United States law or by the International Criminal Court in The Hague. So how do we even know what human rights are? And from there, we could determine if someone violates them.
Great question. And as the question implies, there actually are differences of opinion on the, shall we say, parameters of human rights. Famously, in the communist world, they have considered economic rights to be human rights. In the Western world, we tend not to see it that way. But there is a broad consensus about such things as torture, genocide, war crimes. There are the use and recruitment of child soldiers. There are international conventions covering those crimes, for instance, and the United States is a party to all of those treaties. Domestically, we also enforce U.S. law that covers participants in Nazi-sponsored acts of persecution during World War II. Persecution was famously covered covered under the Nuremberg Charter, under which major Nazi criminals were prosecuted after the war, as a crime against humanity. I would say crime against humanity is an example of where not everyone yet has signed on to the concept. So, for instance, we do not have in this country a crime against humanity federal crime.
So Americans aren't ever prosecuted for violating human, for committing crimes against humanity. Is that correct?
Not per se, but they are prosecuted, for instance, by the U.S. military, if they're U.S. military personnel, or sometimes by the Justice Department, if they have committed any number of constituent offenses. So, for instance, murder. There are ways.
So,
but not under the rubric of crimes against humanity.
So I guess I imagine, and perhaps you know more about this and could elaborate, are there ever claims of American exceptionalism that the American government's Department of Justice is going around the world seeking to enforce some set of universally applicable moral code, yet does not subject its own citizens and soldiers to prosecution in the Netherlands for crimes against humanity because those aren't actually codified in American statute?
Well, the United States is not a party to the International Criminal Court. We have not signed on to the Rome Statute creating it. And the United States has been criticized for that, and other people take the position that we should not participate in the ICC. But the U.S. has rather famously been supportive of any number of ICC undertakings, including prosecutions. And our position as a government is that we can hold and do hold our own people responsible under our domestic law.
So if I suppose you found Nazis or former Nazis, you found them in the United States, but you've also found them in South America and in Canada and in parts of Europe. And so if you had confidence in those cases that those governments would prosecute those individuals to the fullest extent of their laws, would you then back off that case and allow that federal government of that country to prosecute the case as the United States would if it were in our jurisdiction?
Well, in fact, if we're speaking of the World War II Nazi cases, our jurisdiction here in the United States is limited to people who are here or are U.S. citizens living abroad. So we don't actually have jurisdiction over people in Latin America or Europe or elsewhere unless by some chance they have become United States citizens. So it is the responsibility of each country in which the perpetrators reside to either bring them to justice or send them to a country in which they can be. In the United States, we do not have criminal jurisdiction over persons who took part in Nazi crimes, and so our goal since the inception of this program in 1979 has been to get them, so to speak, to countries in Europe, like Germany, most especially Germany, that have that criminal jurisdiction so that they can be brought to justice. And we do that by taking these people to federal district court, proving what they did, obtaining from the court an order of canceling U.S. citizenship, and then we seek to deport these people, as I say, to countries that have criminal jurisdiction.
Interesting. So I'd like to transition you to the topic of your life and how you came to be known popularly, and I'll have you comment on this in a moment, as a Nazi hunter. Now, your own father was, I believe, a war correspondent who was present at the liberation of a Nazi concentration camp during World War II, and the atrocities that he had seen were so terrible that, in fact, he never ended up actually speaking to you about these atrocities because they were too emotional, and his eyes would well up with tears at the very thought of seeing that liberated camp. And so it's such a terrible thing. for him to have experienced once in his life, but it sounds like throughout your life, over decades, you've had, I guess, as part of your job, to have a recurring courtship with this, the terrible atrocities of the past. Whatever could motivate an individual to forever butt heads against the atrocities at the worst, depths of the human experience on a daily basis? What would possess somebody like you to, I guess, commit himself to righting these wrongs and seeking justice and going into the details of decades-old crimes? How do you feel, finally, about the title of being referred to as a Nazi hunter?
Well, Jordan, I would say that when I was in law school, my assumption was, since I had a background in business already then and had an MBA, that I was going to end up either in business or practicing corporate law. But in my first year, I ended up volunteering for a student group that assisted the local district attorney's office. And the case that I was assigned to was a particularly frightening, brutal rape. And I guess I would say the prosecution bug bit me. I was so appalled by the crime and so moved by the opportunity to take part in obtaining at least a measure of justice on behalf of the victim that suddenly I thought, wow, I think I might like to be a prosecutor. And not long thereafter, my former office, the Office of Special Investigations, OSI, was created in the Justice Department. And I thought, well, if you're going to be a prosecutor, why not work on some of the most notorious and calamitous crimes ever committed, namely genocide in Nazi-dominated Europe. And I applied for an internship, and I guess I was the first summer intern. They had a couple of full-year interns, but I was the first summer intern at OSI, and came down to Washington for that and was enthralled with the work, moved by it. I was hugely impressed by the dedication and talents of the small cadre of prosecutors and others who were working on these cases. I also found the challenge of trying to prove crimes that had taken place, as you indicated, decades earlier on the other side of a vast ocean, committed in a manner that was intended to, and usually did, physically eliminate the people who, had they survived, might have been inclined to cooperate with the government investigation. I found all of those challenges daunting on the one hand, of course, but appealing on the other. It's sort of the ultimate prosecutorial or evidentiary jigsaw puzzle. I will say, finally, that the fact that my father had this experience while serving in the Army, where he was actually in the infantry and then an intelligence officer, and was sent to the Dachau concentration camp the day after its liberation to report back to his commanding officer on what was found there, because word had spread very quickly in the area that something terrible was found at Dachau. My dad's inability to speak about it, seeing my father for the first time in my then young life cry, I'm sure had an indelible impact on me and influenced my career pattern. In answer to your question about the appellation Nazi hunter, I've never cared for it for the reason that it makes this field into something that seems to be a sport, as hunting is. It's not a sport. It's serious law enforcement work, one doesn't speak of terrorist hunting or narcotics traffic or hunting or anything like that, and I think this is sort of a result of a lot of popular fiction and motion picture treatments of this subject.
Eli, you mentioned that the work that you do, you say, is serious law enforcement work, but I think we mentioned earlier that the Geneva Convention, which first outlined what human rights were and what might constitute a crime against humanity, in many cases was passed after the actual acts of genocide in many cases. Now, I know
that some genocide continued through the middle of 1945, but I think a good portion of the human rights violations actually, I wonder what land they were, those individuals were breaking, because you're saying enforcing laws, but if the laws are passed after the crime was committed, are you, to what extent are you really doing law enforcement at this ex post facto?
Well, I mean, it's a very good point. The genocide in particular was a crime that wasn't even conceived as such. The term genocide wasn't conceived until 1944 by Raphael Lemkin, a Polish-American scholar, Polish-American Jewish scholar, actually. So the genocide, our genocide law didn't go on to the books until, I think, 1988, after we finally ratified the Genocide Convention, and it wasn't until around 2007 that it became seriously enforceable. That having been said, the civil actions that we undertake or we have undertaken against Nazi criminals, I think, do secure a real measure of justice. We vindicate the principle that these crimes won't be tolerated. We have to prove them in federal court under a standard that is substantially identical to the beyond a reasonable doubt standard that applies in criminal cases, and we do we have in most of those cases sent people to countries that have jurisdiction to prosecute criminally, which they sometimes have done. In our post-World War
II, can I just clarify there?
Yeah.
I just want to clarify for a minute, Eli. So you said that the bulk of your work under the Office of Special Investigations was, which you're no longer working for, but you used to work for, the bulk of your work was in prosecuting civil actions for people who really didn't break a criminal law, because there was no law in Germany that outlawed
that applied
anywhere
here.
In the world.
There was no U.S. law that covered. There was no U.S. law, that's right, covering the crimes committed in Germany. Now, some of them committed fraud offenses when they lied to gain entry or lied to gain citizenship, but the statute of limitations on those crimes usually had long since run.
I was just going to say, before I get to your point, would an appropriate analogy for many Americans listening here may remember Al Capone, who was a notorious murderer in Chicago during the Prohibition days, but who was taken down for tax evasion. Is that the sort of, I guess, analogy that is applicable to taking down Nazi genocidal criminals with a civil action?
I think in some respects it is. You know, you take the law that's given to you that you can enforce and enforce it when you can. Another example would be in some of our cases involving more recently perpetrated atrocities, such as mass murder in Guatemala in the 1980s, we've been able to bring criminal cases for citizenship fraud, naturalization fraud, and actually put people in jail for quite a few years after they're convicted and sentenced. I do want to say that we are able to bring cases in where the evidence is there and where we come temporally and otherwise within the statutory jurisdiction for the actual crimes of genocide, torture, war crimes. Some years ago, we actually brought one of our predecessor units here, brought the very first torture case under federal law and succeeded in convicting Charles Taylor, a.k.a. Chucky Taylor Jr., the son of the former president of Liberia, Charles Taylor Sr., who is serving a sentence in Europe at this point.
So I guess I'm interested in so you spent the bulk of your career prosecuting individuals who committed such heinous acts that repel any civilized mind, that one would assume that they were criminal acts. But again, for decades,
they were not criminal acts, and you have been a federal employee, so you're not a lobbyist, you're not an advocate, you're not going to Congress saying, you know, oh, I don't know, maybe you did go to Congress, but saying, you know, we should make these actually criminal, we should change the law, and I guess, was it ever frustrating to you that you had to prosecute more criminals with civil actions instead of that world law did not potentially reflect what was in your moral consciousness?
Oh, sure. When I, in years gone by, would interview prospective employees, usually either attorneys or historians, I would typically say, if you have a low frustration threshold, this is not the right job for you. And the problems that we did not have criminal jurisdiction, it was one of the main sources of frustration. Yes, it is beyond unfortunate. However, had the countries of Europe that have had and have criminal jurisdiction in these cases discharged their moral obligation, they would have requested extradition, which is an expedited process for transferring a fugitive to a country in which he or she is wanted, or they would at least have prosecuted people after we deported them. Alas, that happened very infrequently, and that too is part of the frustration. A big part of my work for decades now has been trying to persuade reluctant European governments to accept as deportees Nazi perpetrators we are trying to deport, against whom we have won court orders of deportation, and Germany and other countries of Europe have frequently said, we're not taking them back. And that's just not acceptable.
Now, Eli, I know that in the course of some of your prosecutorial history, you found individuals who've aided and abetted the Nazi genocidal actions, but didn't actually pull the trigger themselves. For instance, guards at death camps who maybe didn't actually gas people, but would have, guess, created circumstances in which there would have been genocide, have been guilty of crimes against humanity. And pivoting on that, and this may be a difficult question for you, the United States, after World War II, worked to get Nazi criminals or get former Nazi members of the Nazi Party, prominent members from Europe to the United States, because these individuals would help advance America's interest in the Cold War. Obviously, the most famous is Wernher von Braun, the rocket scientist who helped eventually us land a man on the moon. And obviously, I'm not sure whether you would say he was a war criminal, but he did devise the V-1 and V-2 rockets that wreaked havoc all over London in the Blitz in the 40s. So in a way, America, and then there are other war criminals, Nazis, that America saved and shuttled off to South America and prevented them from being hung in the Nuremberg trials. So would you ever say, since you have prosecuted people for aiding and abetting genocide during World War II, would you say that America is at all at fault for aiding and abetting the escape of Nazi war criminals from Europe after World War II in the midst of the Cold War?
I think that's somewhat further than I would go, but I would say that it is deeply regrettable. Some of the decisions that were made after the war are deeply regrettable. Can be understood only in the context of the Cold War battle between, particularly between the Western Allies and the Soviet Union. On both sides of that conflict, Nazi criminals were employed. I have often said that Nazi criminals, many of them were in a sense among the winners of the Cold War because they escaped prosecution largely as a result of Cold War tensions.
So I guess that begs the question, Eli, what is justice? Obviously, you can't undo a rape. You can't undo a murder. In a sense, you said you can do a civil action, which might create some sort of
sort of monetary punishment. You could put someone in prison, which would punish them, but wouldn't really redeem the victims. It would potentially provide solace to the survivors of the victims. And then if, as you say, America's actions might have been deeply regrettable in the sense that they helped Nazis avoid justice, I guess what were the implications of that? So the question I'd like to pose to you is, what is justice? What have you been working throughout your life to advance this nebulous concept of justice? What is it? What does it look like for you? What are you trying to achieve?
Law professors around the world debate that concept, what is justice? But I mean, justice fundamentally is accountability, holding someone to account for crimes they've committed or participated in, exposing their conduct to the community in which they live, to the public of the country in which they live, and perhaps beyond, giving a measure of showing the surviving victims or the families of those who perished that the government does not accept the concept that the perpetrators of those crimes can live freely unexposed among them, that there's a price to be paid. So, for instance, in the United States, when we succeed in revoking citizenship and deporting someone, one of the consequences is that they lose Social Security benefits. So there is a real price to be paid, and when we have been able to pursue criminal prosecution, we do. And, you know, there are, again, theories of criminal justice involving punishment and involving deterrence in particular. And that's, deterrence is a big part of this. We all of us around the world who work on these kinds of cases want to get to want the world to reach a stage of development in which the perpetrators of human rights crimes will know that there is a very high likelihood that if they do that, if they commit those crimes, they will be pursued for the rest of their lives, even into old age if necessary.
And, of course,
to deter this.
I'd like to ask you, has your faith in the value of deterrence ever wavered? Clearly, there have been there was a Rwanda genocide, there was a Srebrenica massacre in Bosnia, there have been, as you mentioned, there were incidents in Guatemala, there have been many incidents of violations of human rights around the world, many of which continue today. I guess I would ask, have you ever questioned whether any of your actions really do serve as a deterrent to future crimes against humanity, given that so many crimes against humanity continue to persist in the state of current affairs?
It's very easy to get depressed when one looks at what has happened in the world since World War II. The survivors of the Holocaust, for instance, always remind us of the slogan, two slogans, never forget, but also never again. And it is there was a belief after World War II that the shock of the Holocaust would ensure that mass atrocities and other human rights violations would cease to occur. And obviously that hasn't been so. There's no way to easily prove deterrence, but in the absence of anything better, I suppose, we cling to the hope that law enforcement can achieve some level of deterrence.
So, Eli, we are approaching the end of the podcast, unfortunately. It has been a wonderful ride these last 25 minutes or so. I would like to ask you a final two-part question. I ask all my guests this. My audience has come to rely upon these questions being asked at the conclusion of each episode. Eli, I'd like to ask you to speak to our audience about why it has been worthwhile to advance the public interest through the prosecution of these war criminals. What really has been driving you on a day-in and day-out basis through the grudge of looking through 60-year-old photographs and wedding records and immigration files? It must be a slog. I guess if you could elaborate on, I guess, the higher noble cause that makes you think, you know, I'm advancing the public interest, and that's what makes it worthwhile. And then, of course, I'd like to ask you to reflect on what your legacy would be, what you hope you have achieved by becoming the longest-serving prosecutor of human rights violations in the world.
I would say what inspires me, and I would expect my colleagues as well, to persist in this deeply depressing work is the experience of meeting survivors of these crimes, whether it be the Holocaust or the Dos Eras massacre in Guatemala, or massacres in former Yugoslavia and elsewhere, the courage that they have to reopen psychological wounds that can never heal, in order to relate to us their horrifying experiences, in the hope of helping us pursue justice. The experience of getting a hug from one of these survivor witnesses after he or she has testified stays with you forever. The appreciation that the surviving victims and families have for efforts by prosecutors the world over to pursue justice in these cases, that's what keeps you going through the depression that constantly threatens to overwhelm you. As far as the legacy is concerned, I think I'll have to leave that to others, except since I am also the self-appointed cheerleader for this office. I think if one looks at our current office, the Human Rights and Special Prosecution Section, and its two predecessors, one can see that the United States in recent decades has been a world leader in efforts to secure justice in the wake of human rights violations. And I think that is consistent with U.S. history and with the kind of nation that we aspire to be.
And that's been Eli Rosenbaum, the longest-serving prosecutor and investigator of Nazi criminals and other perpetrators of human rights violations in world history. He's a director of the Human Rights Enforcement Strategy and Policy Group at DOJ's Human Rights and Special Prosecution Section. He's a former director of the DOJ Office of Special Investigations. And he speaks about justice and about bringing justice to the doorsteps of those Japanese soldiers that committed the rape of Nanking. He speaks about those German soldiers that gassed and machine gunned 6 million Jews down in the 1940s and the late 30s. He speaks about individuals who go above the call of their nation's duty in serving as a man of war. It's not killing, but it's killing the defenseless. It's killing civilians. It's wholesale slaughter and massacre. He isn't prosecuting the bomber who dropped in the Enola Gay, who dropped an atomic bomb and basically a few men in an airplane led to 80,000 deaths in an instant. He wasn't trying to prosecute Albert Einstein, who thought who developed, I guess, the atomic bomb and the Manhattan Project. But Eli is a special sort of person who violates, who commits a crime against humanity, violates our moral sensibility. It's not just killing someone. It's not killing a bunch of people. It's attacking a defenseless, vulnerable population to achieve no military objective, but only to destroy a sense of our very humanity. And so for Eli, advancing the public interest is being a champion of human rights, bringing accountability to the doorstep of those who have violated our sense of humanity. He owns the term justice and hopes that his work will serve as a deterrent to future violations that may come in the future. He is willing to admit that the United States has is not blameless and has had moments in its history of which we may not be the most proud, but he stands by the American government's efforts to do what it can to try to make the past right to the best of its abilities. And with Eli's help, perhaps we are well on our way. Eli, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks again for having me, Jordan.
This has been another episode of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. I'll remind you to subscribe on publicinterestpodcast.com and on iTunes. Leave a review of this podcast on iTunes and listen on Stitcher, SoundCloud, CastBox, Blueberry, Player FM, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube. Should you wish to comment on this episode, you're welcome to leave a voicemail at 240-630-0380. And the first 3 minutes of that voicemail may be played in future episodes of Public Interest Podcast. Should you wish to support the podcast, you're welcome to leave a contribution in an amount that you feel comfortable with at publicinterestpodcast.com. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.